Was heartbreaking. He had a real struggle after the game of cricket. An unbelievable man, unbelievable character. In an era, we talk about Michael Atherton, Nasser Hussain, Alex Stewart, the average between sort of 35 and 40. The judge, Robin Smith, averaged over 43. He was a phenomenal player, a great guy. And in that time, I was 18-year-old, wet behind the ear. We had a beer with him after that game at Chester Street in a 4-day game. And he put your arm around you, had a chat, talked about his he thoughts of your future and wishing you all the best. And every time I seen him during them England times, he always with a warm embrace, strong embrace. And the cricket in England is sadly missing an absolute legend with his passing this year, the last 24 hours.
Magnificent cricketer and an absolutely honest human being. Steve Harmison, former England fast bowler, TalkSport cricket commentator, thanks very much for your time today. Don't forget, you can read Mike Atherton every day in the Times. Sky do not have the broadcast rights to the Ashes this year, so if you want to know what our chief cricket correspondent, a former England captain himself, thinks, go to thetimes.com or the Live app. Thanks for your company this afternoon. My producer today was Lizzie Highfield, and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Next on Times Radio, it's Rosie Wright and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
That is indeed what we are. Thank you, Jeremy. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio.
Coming up on the show today, the Prime Minister stood firmly behind his Chancellor at Prime Minister's questions following last week's highly contested budget. We'll hear from the Times politics team. We'll speak to the charity fundraiser who's received a star-studded hand-me-down from a very famous Friends actor. And our big guest today, Aline van der Velden, joins us to reveal why she created the world's first very beautiful AI actor and what it means for the future of film.
All of that happens after the latest news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch has said the head of the Office for Budget Responsibility lost his job because he did the right thing. Richard Hughes resigned on Monday. The OBR has said a much-reported downturn in productivity used to justify tax increases in the budget was balanced out by a rise in tax receipts.
We now know that the head of the OBR was forced out for telling the truth that the Chancellor did not need to raise taxes on working people. We also know that the Chancellor was briefing the media, twisting the facts, all so she could break her promises and raise taxes.
Badenoch also claimed that if Chancellor Rachel Reeves worked in the private sector, she would have been sacked. Reeves shook her head while Keir Starmer said Badenoch was losing the plot. A nursery worker has admitted sexually assaulting children in North London. 45-year-old Vincent Chan pleaded guilty to 26 offences. Detectives say he used his workplace to commit a calculated and predatory pattern of abuse. Solicitor Alison Miller has spoken on behalf of some of the families affected.
We trust the judge to pass the strongest sentence to fit the crimes Vincent Chan has committed against young children, innocent victims who could not fight back. How was someone like Vincent Chan employed? Why did safeguarding systems fail completely?
The nursery group involved is reviewing safeguarding procedures. The Kremlin says it's wrong to suggest that Vladimir Putin rejected the US proposed peace plan with Ukraine that was discussed yesterday. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov says Putin accepted some of the proposals and rejected others in what was a normal negotiation process. Earlier, Putin said Russia was ready if Europe wanted to go to war. High profile Kremlin critic Sir Bill Browder has told Times Radio he should be taken at his word.
We're in a situation in which Vladimir Putin, in order to stay in power, needs foreign enemies. He sent in 16 attack drones into Poland, 3 fighter jets into Estonia. They're digging up internet cables in the Baltic. They're doing all sorts of nasty stuff. We're already at war with Russia. It's just a hybrid war.
Plans for baby formula to be made available on retailers' loyalty schemes have been announced. The Prime Minister has pledged to save parents up to £500 before their child's first birthday. And the King and Queen have welcomed the German President to Windsor Castle for a state visit. Frank-Walter Steinmeier and his wife will be treated to a state banquet. A six-metre Christmas tree decorated with 3,000 lights will be the backdrop to these celebrations. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, in the interest of full transparency, it is the wonderful Rosie Wright with us this afternoon. We are going to canter towards 4 o'clock. Very much hope that you can keep us company too. We are 0333 003 2353 for the afternoon, and we remain Jane and Fee at times.radio if you'd like to email us your thoughts. Anything we're talking about, we love it when you discuss it with us too. So welcome to our Wednesday lair. We're going to start with a roundup of PMQ. We neatly tack into Courtney Cox's bag of secondhand clothes. The Friend Star read about a woman called Caroline Jones who vowed to wear secondhand clothes every day for a year to raise money for charity. She's been doing it for nearly a decade. She's raised £70,000. And Courtney Cox this year has tipped in with the contribution of a beautiful black Yves Saint Laurent bag. Good for her. We're going to talk to Caroline Jones in this half an hour of the programme. We also talk telly with Scott Bryan. Fix your bottoms to the sofa on New Year's Day, both Traitors and the latest season of The Night Manager come your way. After 3 o'clock today, we will take a very sharp look at Putin's desire for peace. Can anyone find evidence of that being real? And our guest after 3:30 is a remarkable young woman. You might want to remember her name. She is Aline van der Velden. She's a tech entrepreneur and she's created one of the world's first AI actresses. And I suppose we should really say the first AI actor, who is called Tilly Norwood. So if you want to take a little moment to search Tilly Norwood, it will definitely help you understand our interview after 3:30. Because if you don't know that she is an AI creation, she is so believably real, Rosie, isn't she?
Real and completely beautiful. She's got her own Instagram account and has caused an absolute stir in Hollywood. She hasn't been in sort of a blockbuster production yet, but if you look at the posts posted on Instagram, she looks very believable. She looks very charming. She's sort of an English rose. So she's got nice sort of flushed cheeks, lovely long brown hair, big brown wide eyes. And it's caused a stir in Hollywood because actresses, actors, all actors, writers who are already really nervous about the impact of AI. If we remember just 2 years ago, the Hollywood writers' strike, based nervously on what was going to happen when tech would write scripts rather than humans. We're now the next stage of that already, just 2 years on, to say, well, maybe tech and code will be your actors instead. And supposedly Tilly Norwood is in conversations, or her managers, in which case, in this case, the AI firms, in conversations with talent agencies, jostling to sign her. I expect she will be the first of many.
Yeah. And that's the thing, isn't it? Because I think I'm very worried about AI. I'm worried about what it means for my kids. They're not far off entering the jobs market and they're having to completely recalibrate what an entry-level job might look like. And so I view AI definitely through a prism of fear. But it has been fascinating talking to Aline van der Velden, because her point is that actually in creating Tilly Norwood, she has created more jobs than Tilly Norwood will take from the industry, because the number of people that you need to build this extraordinary code, and then you still need people to do social media, you still need lawyers to represent her, as far-fetched as that might sound, you still need the same kind of people, maybe just doing different things around an AI persona as you do the real person. And there was something in the interview where I actually felt a little bit reassured. I started off from definitely the left-hand side of the Caran d'Ache box of pencils. It was very, very dark indeed, and I've gone through the full spectrum. I'm not quite at the other side yet, but there is a little bit of brightness. So I suppose all I'm trying to say is I need to keep an open mind. We all need to keep an open mind, because this is just going to happen and we can't all hide behind the back of the sofa.
Do we want to watch the film that is starring Tilly Norwood?
Well, I'm not a big fan of animation. I'm not a big fan of cartoon. I'm not a big fan of, you know, some of the CGIs that happen in film at the moment. It's not for me, but I think actually there will be a whole generation who will think, I'm going to the cinema to see an AI movie. And then the next weekend, they might go to the cinema to see something that actually stars a real person. That's Aline's point as well.
Yeah.
But it's really fascinating. We are trying to bend our minds around something, and we're not quite sure what form it should take at the moment. So we would really love you to stay with us and listen to that interview at 3:30 and let us know your thoughts. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. In at number 3, Rachel Reeves accused of overstating junior chess title. Now, a former junior champion said Reeves didn't hold the official British Girls Under 14 title, and critics asked broader questions about her CV and her career claims. The second most read story, Andrew won't get payout after leaving Royal Lodge as house dilapidated. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's rental arrangements, which were exposed by the Times, have triggered an inquiry by the Public Accounts Committee. And the most read piece on the Times website, Zelensky's meeting with US envoy cancelled after peace talks stall. The planned Brussels briefing was abruptly abandoned after Steve Witkoff's five-hour session with Putin failed to produce a deal. We will talk more about that one after 3 o'clock on the programme. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. In harmony, everybody, if you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
It's 9 minutes past two. Let's have a look at what happened at lunchtime with Prime Minister's questions. Well, the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, has called for the Chancellor again to resign in the first PMQ since the budget.
One of his ministers said the Chancellor and Prime Minister look weak and incompetent. The country agrees. We know that there were endless Treasury briefings to justify raising taxes on hardworking people to pay for benefits. And those briefings had real-world consequences. Hundreds of thousands of people drew down their pension, an irreversible act. So the Prime Minister pays tribute to the head of the OBR. If the head of the OBR had to resign over market-sensitive leaks, why is the Chancellor still in her job?
Yeah. Well, the Prime Minister responded by attacking the Conservative record, praising Labour's achievements and asking for an apology.
What she doesn't understand, that picking up a £16 billion tab for their failure is not a good starting point for any budget. And the OBR said yesterday, Mr. Speaker, that Chancellor's speech was not misleading. So if the Leader of the Opposition had any decency, she'd get up now and apologise.
Watching it all play out was Ben Clatworthy, Whitehall editor of The Times, who joins us now. Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon, Rosie.
They keep repeating this, don't they, the Tories? They say the Chancellor should go. How convincing is that attack line?
Well, I think the thing is that the Chancellor and the Prime Minister are so closely linked to one another in this partnership. There's very little sign of any friction between the two of them. So if the Chancellor were to go, it would be inevitable that the Prime Minister was also on the way out. So there is no suggestion whatsoever that she is going to go. But there is still unease about the whole budget process and what was known when and who was told what when. And cabinet ministers have spoken to my colleagues and said that they felt that they were only given the doom and gloom, that the improved forecasts from the OBR were never reflected, and they only found out about them when Richard Hughes, the now departed chief executive of the OBR, published that letter last Friday saying, because of the amount of speculation around the budget, that he felt that they needed to be transparent. He published a letter to the Treasury Select Committee that showed that at the point that Rachel Reeves made that incredible press conference at breakfast time, interrupting sort of breakfast TV to say that it was all doom and gloom and bad news, and she would have to almost imply that she would have to raise income tax. Actually, at that point, she was in the black, albeit only by a couple of billion pounds. And that unease still remains today.
Yeah, and it isn't going away, is it, Ben? Because unusually for a Prime Minister's questions after the budget, we are consumed with talking about what happened before it, not the details of actually what was announced.
Yes, totally. At this point, you would normally expect them to have picked through the red book, the opposition this is, and start to be hammering them on little-known policies that were not necessarily spoken about in the chamber on budget day, but were buried in the document. That is the sort of usual pattern of events after a budget. Here, we're still talking, as you say, about what happened in the run-up to it, who knew what, and also whether she actually needed to raise taxes in the way that she chose to, which a cynic would say was actually to appease backbenchers by giving lots of spending measures, particularly on welfare, to try and basically shore up her and the Prime Minister's position.
Yeah, I mean, Kemi Badenoch didn't let up. This was her next question.
No one believes a word that the Prime Minister says. We now know the black hole was fake, her book was fake, her CV was fake, even her chess claims are made up. She doesn't belong in the Treasury, she belongs in La La Land. They raised taxes on working people, that £16 billion, was to increase benefits to protect them from their back benches. He now boasts about removing the two-child benefit cap, but he used to say that it was unaffordable. He even removed the whip from seven of them for wanting the same thing. He is very happy to throw them under a bus when it pleases him. So I asked the Prime Minister, how did it suddenly become affordable at the very time he needed to save his own skin?
Mr. Speaker, the vast majority of families we helped in the budget are in work. Yes. Three quarters of children in poverty are in working families. Their policy of nearly 10 years on the two-child benefit cap had one result and one result only. It dragged hundreds of thousands of children into poverty. They should be utterly ashamed of that. And I'm very proud that we're lifting 500,000 children out of poverty.
And Ben, on that, one of the sort of chief criticisms that keeps coming from the Conservatives to the Labour government is this was a budget actually for your own MPs, not for the public. How did the Prime Minister respond?
Yes, well, that accusation is being levelled. I've heard several times this week people saying, look, they, before that, when they were in opposition, when they were in the election campaign, they were saying it was time to put country first, party second. And that budget was aimed squarely at putting party first to keep those backbenchers behind them. And that is a criticism that they're going to struggle to shake off after the events of last Wednesday. There's also a lot of criticism about that press conference in the run-up to the budget as well, because, again, it plays into that idea that they were being economical with the truth about the state of the public finances and basically scaring people and making the economy uneasy. The other thing to note is that actually Kemi Badenoch is doing seemingly more confident appearances at Prime Minister's questions, which is helping shore up her support among Tory backbenchers. Of course, there's not that many of them, but they are getting more and more impressed by her appearances at the dispatch box on a Wednesday.
I think it was a surprise, really, to her colleagues how well she performed at the budget. She did obviously have somewhat of a head start, having had that leak beforehand and so many public leaks in the run-up to the budget to know roughly what she'd have to be countering. A new topic that has sort of started to enter conversation again, Ben, is our relationship with the EU. There are some suggestions that the government wants to move closer to the EU. Is the feeling really that, could we re-enter the European Union? How much more warm could that relationship get?
I think it's fair to say that this will send a shudder down many listeners' spines, that Brexit is back now. It's back on the table. It's back being discussed. It was interesting, after the Prime Minister's questions, we have a chat with the Prime Minister's press spokesperson, and she was saying that the red lines have been set out very clearly. That means not going back into the EU, not going back into the customs union, but that Keir Starmer has been able to reset relations with the EU. And she was pressed on where some of those deals are, but actually with the EU, there hasn't been a huge amount of progress. And she was very quick to say, well, actually, he's reset relations on the world stage. But repeatedly, she was asked about whether there would be a place back in the customs unions, for example. She was adamant that that was crossing a red line. But then when asked about whether that would stand in, for example, a manifesto in the run-up to an election, she said, she pointed back to those red lines. But that's the interesting point, is that at the moment you could see a world where potentially in 4 years' time, Labour are talking about putting something in the manifesto to do with Europe that's far more drastic than at the moment. And it's also interesting that the rhetoric, the lines that they're using have changed. And they are now saying that, you know, they are coming with the cold reality that actually Brexit has been bad for businesses, that it has put up barriers to trade, that there are frictions with the EU that were never necessarily talked about in the run-up to the referendum, particularly by the Brexiteer side. And it's interesting to see that that language is changing, that they are talking. You know, we have seen successive governments and successive prime ministers try and talk up the freedoms, the potential that benefits that Brexit bring. What Keir Starmer is doing now is starting to say, well, actually, we have to be honest about the fact that Brexit has made life for businesses harder.
Yeah, I think this Labour government are much happier to talk maybe more frankly or just in a more bruising way about some of the impacts of Brexit. Wes Streeting was doing that, the Health Secretary, on Breakfast this morning. One of the chief architects of Brexit, Nigel Farage, there is a rumour going round, Ben. Can you tell us what your sense is here? That Nigel Farage has told donors privately that he expects, actually, when we get to the next election, that Reform UK will do a deal with the Conservatives. Now, the official line from the Conservatives and Reform is that they're not exploring this, but it seems maybe they are.
Well, it was very interesting that both sides came out with a line quite so quickly, categorically denying that. And sometimes with these things, it's better to actually take a breath before responding, because your response can be so hasty that it then unravels. There's been particular speculation today about whether Robert Jenrick, the shadow Justice Secretary, might be a potential reform candidate. A potential defector. He was asked this morning on Times Radio categorically that there are rumours about the idea that he would be Chancellor in a hypothetical future Reform government. He was very quick to say that it was only yesterday that he was in the running to be leader of the Conservative Party, and that that's where his heart is, effectively. But there's definitely a rumour mill that is in action, and it is natural that conversations will be being had. But as I say, Nigel Farage last night was very quick to say that those conversations that were reported in the Financial Times with donors didn't happen. Robert Jenrick this morning was quite funny when he was doing his round, saying that he can't comment on what Nigel Farage might have said over a boozy lunch with his city friends.
Okay. Ben, thank you very much. Ben Clatworthy, Whitehall editor of The Times, thank you very much.
I tell you what, Labour might be happy to talk about Brexit now, but they ran a mile from answering questions about it in the run-up to the election. It's 21 minutes past two. Coming up, which celebrity would you most want a hand-me-down from? You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Step inside our Hotel Chocolat cafes and experience the festive magic with our limited edition drinking chocolates crafted by our chocolatiers. Sink into the crisp, creamy notes of peppermint white or the delicate spices of mince pie. Topped with cocoa whip, the crowning glory. Light as air, intensely chocolatey. Oh, go on then. It is Christmas after all. Discover your new obsession only in Hotel Chocolat cafes.
Okay, James, I need you to do a few more drops than yesterday, I'm afraid.
Carl needs to find another driver for his expanding courier business. Someone who'll really help to lighten the load.
Any issues, give me a call.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do.
South today, what about you?
Indeed helps you quickly attract, screen and virtually interview great candidates, all through an easy-to-use dashboard. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens.
Choose Wickes for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk. Any excuse for it. Courtney Cox, best known as Monica from Friends, has sent an Yves Saint Laurent handbag across the pond to support a British woman's year-long charity shop fundraising challenge. Caroline Jones has vowed to wear second-hand outfits every day for a year, raising money for Cancer Research UK as part of her Knickers Models Own campaign, which she began 10 years ago. Caroline joins us now. Hello, Caroline. How are you?
Hi, Fee. I'm really well. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely our pleasure. Tell us a little bit more about your Knickers Models Own campaign.
Absolutely. Well, Knickers Models Own is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, and it's a reference to the fact that my pants are always my own, but everything else you see me wearing is from Cancer Research UK all year this year. And I do have history. I spent a whole year in 2015 also fundraising for the same charity for a whole year after I lost my mum to breast cancer. So I've come back to it 10 years on to complete the circle.
How much money have you raised?
I have raised to date £70,000. And my free prize draw that I think we're going to talk about with regard to the bag, that is also money that's going to go into the pot as well. So it's just incredible to see the generosity of people.
Yeah. So that's 70,000 pounds. It's astonishing, Caroline. Congratulations to you. It's such a simple idea, isn't it? And it taps into a place where a lot of us would like to be, but perhaps, I don't know, not bold enough to completely go.
Well, I always said, Fee, at the beginning of when I first started fundraising, that actually this was a bit of a light challenge. I didn't really compare it to sweating, running up a mountain, cycling, or doing anything intensive. But actually dressing up in style is what I'm really good at. It's what I'm passionate about. And through the lens of secondhand, where you can create your own look, you can break the rules, you can set your own, you know, looks every day. For me, that was just something that was very logical in my mum's memory. So that's, yeah, I set out just dressing up every day wearing secondhand. And really, I think it was to help with my own grief and sort of to lift my mood.
Yeah, well, what a lovely thing to do. I'm sure your mum would be very, very proud of you. What are some of the things that you have managed to find in the secondhand clothing departments?
Gosh, I mean, so many beautiful things. If I think off the top of my head, a beautiful Hermes silk scarf in immaculate condition, still in its beautiful orange sleeve. Vintage pieces, you know, they're always the pieces that I love to find, whether it's St. Michael, whether it's Jaeger, Aquascutum, Vivian Westwood. I've got a beautiful cardigan. You know, charity shops are rich in beautiful garments. You just have to spend some time looking.
Yep. When did Courtney throw her bag into the ring?
Well, quite literally across the pond. So we were having conversations. I've got a really dear friend that's supporting me on my campaign, and he is very good friends with Courtney. So Courtney heard about my story back in the summer and just said, you know, I just love the idea of Caroline dressing up every day. What a brilliant idea. And very generously said, look, how can I support? Let me send you something. And she did indeed. She sent me this amazing YSL round camera bag, which is a joy to hold. And I'm forever grateful because it's hugely impactful for my campaign. And she also was very generous and filmed a clip of herself talking to camera so we could incorporate that into my social media.
Tell us a little bit more about the bag. For those of us who aren't familiar with the bags of Yves Saint Laurent, how big is it? Yeah. Is it a crossbody bag? And that's about all I've got in terms of questions.
I have to have it here, Fee. Would you like me to hold it up?
Yes, please.
I know it's radio. But
it's all right.
Do
you know what? We're radio with pictures these days, so absolutely go for
it. Very good. Yeah. So here we go. Look at this. So it's called the round camera bag. Round, obviously, quilted, black, with this really weighty chain. And one lucky person that enters the free prize draw in my social link, in my bio, could win this.
Wow.
It's extraordinary.
How many people have entered so far?
Gosh, I think over 400 people. And in terms of money, we've had £3,600 already, and we only launched on Monday midday. So it's just been incredible, the impact it's had. And I suppose it's a little bit like a lucky dip. You know, you can give me your £10 and the money's going to Cancer Research UK, or it's a free prize draw. You can send me a good old-fashioned stamped address envelope. And, yeah, you could be styling up Courtney Cox's bag. You could have that in your wardrobe.
Well, do you have any idea what the recommended retail price of that item might be, Caroline? Presumably hundreds, maybe even, you know, topping out at thousands.
I think four digits, definitely. Yeah. Over 1,000, between 1,000 and 1,500, maybe 2,000. But of course, with the provenance of Courtney, and I feel like that's probably adding on.
Oh, double. Gosh, definitely. And, you know, Friends is such a hit show throughout the ages, isn't it? So, you know, we've got youngsters who absolutely adore Courtney Cox. We've got people, I'm just suggesting this to our listeners, that might be slightly more advanced in years, have deeper pockets, who might want to own a bag that was once owned by Courtney. So there is plenty of opportunity, isn't there, to dig deep, yeah, and do some really, really good work at the same time. Do you want to give out all of the details, Caroline, in case people want to immediately release their wallets?
Thank you so much. So you can find me across the social platforms that you connect with. My account name is Knickers_models_own. That's on Instagram. You can find my link in the bio, the link to the competition. You can look me up on Just Giving. I'm on Facebook. I'm on TikTok. I am everywhere. But you'll find the links in all of my bios, and yeah, have a go.
Yeah, you said that in rather a threatening way there, Caroline.
I didn't mean it. Oh dear.
It's good.
Call to action.
Yes, it's good you're everywhere. We wish you the very best of luck, and thank you very much indeed for coming on and talking to us. So it is beautiful. Rosie and I've just seen. Oh, here it comes. Hang on. I'll shush. God, we've all got a moment in time, haven't we, that we go to when we hear that theme tune. The bag looks gorgeous.
It does. It's in immaculate condition. I think the fear would be, do you save it for best or do you use it every day? I'd probably put it on a shelf in a dust bag and it would never actually venture outside of the house.
I so wouldn't. I would wear it every day I'd put a sticker on it saying, ask me about this bag, because then I'd be able to say, do you know who this belonged to? And strike up a conversation.
Excellent. We've had a very lovely message in from Rita from Cranley. He says, please give a shout out to the team in Cranley who organised a sustainable fashion show using only garments from our four charity shops in the village. At the end of the show, we could all buy the outfits, proceeds to the charity shops. Great show as ever. Thank you. Lots to come here. Has international law had its day? We'll look at the complications with actually enacting it. That is after the news at 2:30 with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch has said the head of the Office for Budget Responsibility was forced out for telling the truth. During Prime Minister's questions, she also claimed that if Chancellor Rachel Reeves worked in the private sector, she would have been sacked after last week's budget. The OBR said a downturn in productivity used to justify tax increases was balanced out by a rise in tax receipts. Its former head, Richard Hughes, resigned on Monday. A nursery worker has pleaded guilty to 26 serious sexual offences against children. 45-year-old Vincent Chan worked at a nursery in North London between 2017 and 2024. The charges against him included sexual assault and taking indecent photographs. Detective Superintendent Lewis Basford says a whistleblower provided information.
We recognise the member of staff who raised their concerns, as without this first report of child cruelty, Chan's abuse could have continued unchecked, putting countless more children at risk. Our investigation remains ongoing and we are continuing to review digital devices and assess Chan's conduct across relevant settings.
Supermarkets are to get updated guidance confirming that baby formula can be bought using loyalty schemes and coupons. The Prime Minister says it could save new parents about £500 a year. And Israel is preparing to open the Rafah crossing in the coming days to allow residents of Gaza to cross into Egypt for reasons including medical treatment. A specific time has not been given. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. Just £30 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £30, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms. The free bathroom design service includes a home visit. So when you're ready to plan your new bathroom, let the Wix experts measure up for you. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Victoria informs us that an Hermes scarf is nearly 500 quid. Kirsty says, I've just donated. What a wonderful idea for a fantastic cause. Go Caroline. And we've just looked it up. And that particular bag, the cheapest you'll be able to find it online, is at £1,392.10. And that's on one of those fashion, I don't want to call it a kind of outlet store place, but it's on one of those websites that isn't the Yves Saint Laurent website itself. Presumably it'll be even more expensive on that. So as Caroline was saying, what with the provenance and everything, it is definitely worth a punt. So if you go on to Just Giving and you type in any of those kind of connected things, you'll be taken to Caroline's page and we'll give out the full details again in a couple of moments' time.
John Pina has just walked into the studio ahead of his own programme at 4 o'clock this afternoon. John, give us a glimpse of what's coming up.
So Ukraine. I mean, look, we saw what happened or didn't happen in Moscow. And there's more talking going on in Brussels later on. There's going to be a Ukrainian negotiator going off to America. You could call it desperately hard going as diplomacy, or you could call it, as I sort of think I prefer, a complete charade, where Vladimir Putin is just stringing along everyone who is being strung along, whether they want it to be that way or whether they do not. I'm going to be, well, catching up with that, which will sound, I think, pretty familiar to a lot of people, but also talking to people who really know what this is about. That's people on the ground in Ukraine. So I'm going to be talking to a man who was in occupied Mariupol. He got out just after the Russians took over the place. Now he's in contact with people there, studying what's going on. And he's given me a real insight into what it's like on the ground in occupied Ukraine. And I don't know how many people really knew, because I did not, that there is a real resistance movement in occupied Ukraine. People who are fighting and sabotaging equipment and installations and so on. Well, there is. And I'm going to be talking to an academic who is here in London, but in contact with resistance fighters and saboteurs and keeping track of what they're doing. So we'll get a bit of an insight into that as well.
Is there a sense, John, if these conversations we've had, you know, that five-hour meeting with President Putin, isn't engineering really anything that the European allies or that Ukraine would want, what is the alternative strategy if it isn't sitting down and talking?
Well, I mean, at the moment, I think as far as Ukraine's concerned, there is no alternative but to keep on doing this diplomacy, however pointless it is, because they simply cannot say what many of them must feel, which is that it is a charade, and they don't especially trust Donald Trump. They're really worried, above all, that he's going to walk away. And we've just been hearing in Brussels Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, praising Donald Trump for his efforts to achieve peace. Diplomacy means saying things you don't mean. I think, you know, Russ's great fear is of Trump walking away, and he does not want to open the door to that. So you've got to keep on saying the right things in hope that it leads somewhere.
Okay, John, thank you very much. John will be here from 4 o'clock here on Times Radio. Sticking on that theme somewhat, is international law achieving what it aims to? Can it right now? The International Criminal Court currently has arrest warrants out for the leaders of Hamas, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Russia's President Vladimir Putin. That doesn't appear to have stopped the Russian leader today meeting with US representatives. In fact, though, if we step out a little bit, international law itself seems to be under pressure. The US have reportedly been threatening negotiators in one deal and facing new allegations themselves of war crimes in the Caribbean. Robert Volterra is a world-leading international lawyer and partner at Volterra Fieta. Robert, good afternoon. Robert, hello, are you there?
I am. Good afternoon.
Excellent. Robert, just in very layman's terms, can you explain for us, you know, what is international law and what is the International Criminal Court meant to be achieving?
Well, those are both great questions. And of course, these are challenging times for the global community and make those questions much more relevant. International law is the law that governs relationships between countries. That means war, peace. The rules of war, the rules of peace. That means treaties, it means international human rights. It means trade. It means all the relationships at the state-to-state level between countries. It's a form of law that's different from any domestic legal system. And it's been around for a few hundred years, perhaps 500 or 600 years, but it's much less developed and sophisticated in terms of the precision of most of its rules than domestic law, say the English common law or Canadian law. I'm Canadian. So international law is primarily designed to prevent and reduce conflict between states by applying the rule of law and clear rules and norms to all the states in the international system. Now there are 193 or so. It's not a big community, but it's governed by very clear legal principles. Those principles are not the way you or I might want states to behave because you or I have a particular moral or ethical view of the world. It's designed to stop armed conflict and the horrendous human suffering that results from it. It, just like any legal system, it is not perfect. It does not achieve results all the time. But just, for example, because there is a murder in the United Kingdom, people don't say, oh, right, that's it. Throw away the law. It's no good. Most international law is applied all the time, every day, between states in hundreds of thousands of small interactions. And sometimes the world sees enormous violations of international law, like a war or a war crime. Just like in the United Kingdom, millions of people comply with millions of laws every single day, all the time, but we still occasionally see about a murder or whatever. The International Criminal Court is a very important step for the international community, but it has its limits. It's not a court of universal jurisdiction like the English High Courts or the magistrates that enforce criminal law in the UK. It is an international organization that's called a court. And only the countries that have signed up to that international organization and court, only those countries are bound by the rules of the court. And only their nationals can be affected, properly understood by those rules of that court.
And other countries who aren't members can exert significant pressure. I mean, the president of the International Criminal Court said at the beginning of the meeting this week, they wouldn't bow to pressure from the United States and Russia. What kind of pressure are those two countries trying to apply?
Well, as I understand it, both of those countries are seeking to achieve certain outcomes, different outcomes. The United States, for example, is not a party to that treaty. It is not a party to the Statute of Rome. It's not a state subject to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. And for some 25, 30 years, various presidents of the United States consistently, not just Donald Trump, but consistently for the last 25, 30 years, have been entering into bilateral treaties with countries that are members of the criminal court to ensure that U.S. nationals are not inadvertently caught up in the procedures of the International Criminal Court. So the United States doesn't want any U.S. national, for example, its military, ever to be subject to the rules and proceedings in the International Criminal Court. As a non-party, it is perfectly entitled to do that. That is not illegal or inappropriate. The United Kingdom is party to any number of international treaties, which it must follow, but it's also not party to other treaties, and the United Kingdom would be grossly offended if other countries tried to make the UK subject to those treaties it hasn't signed.
We've got lots of tensions right now globally. We've already talked about, and we will get into more detail, the conversations that have been going on between US negotiators and President Putin just in the last few hours. But let's say a specific example. The Trump administration, as you've mentioned, America is not a member of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. The Trump administration is currently being accused of committing war crimes in the Caribbean, killing alleged drug traffickers. It blew up some boats. From your perspective, as an international lawyer, would that be a war crime?
Well, again, that's an excellent question. And not to duck it, the answer is I don't know. I have not seen sufficient facts for such a determination to be made. I must say that one of the things that I constantly notice in the press of Western countries is the early and often inappropriate use of inflammatory conclusions as language. So a country does something I don't like, it's a war crime. I like a certain group of migrants, I call them a refugee. I don't like another group of migrants, and I call them illegal immigrants. These are just labels that are used, and they're not used precisely most of the time. There were a number of things that have been happening in the Caribbean. The facts are, as I understand them, that some U.S. Military planes and so on have been blowing up certain boats, and they seem to be staffed by people running drugs. But there is insufficient evidence on the basis of that to conclude that there is a war crime, that there is, because a war crime requires, whether under the Statute of Rome or just customary international law or the Geneva Conventions, it requires there to be an armed conflict. Is there an armed conflict in the Caribbean? I'm not certain. A situation of death caused by a military machine is not necessarily an armed conflict. And then there's all sorts of baggage, legal baggage that goes around that. So merely making an assertion of a legal conclusion based on certain facts, the details of which are not known, is not really going to move the needle, whether or not the U.S. is part of the Statute of Rome and the ICC. The laws of war and international criminal law apply outside the ICC as well. They're custom. They apply generally, the Geneva Conventions and so on. Those will apply to the United States about how they can conduct armed conflict. But it's not clear to me that anything that's happened in the Caribbean is a violation.
Fulfills that criteria at this point. And it's interesting, actually, that rarely do we have sort of America and Russia bracketed in the same category as they were at the beginning of that meeting earlier this week. Robert, thank you for explaining some of the complexities. Robert Volterra, international lawyer. It's deeply complex. It's frustrating when you think, oh, right, we've got this international court that would like to arrest President Putin, but the practicalities in reality are that that is not going to happen. And when world leaders want to, let's say, have a face-to-face meeting with President Putin, they will meet somewhere on more neutral territory so that any of those complexities are not important.
So out of the jurisdiction. It is a get out of jail because I'm never even going to consider being in jail card, isn't it? Our listeners completely agree with that. Mike says international law is a toothless tiger and has always been so. Without robust means of enforcement, it will always be flouted by powerful tyrants in pursuit of their objectives. And Chris Miller says, I can't simply opt out of UK law if I don't feel like obeying it. We are going to talk television in a couple of moments' time with TV critic to the stars. That would be the one and only Scott Bryan. You're listening to Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
This is Times Radio.
It is 10 minutes to 3. Just to update you, if you were frantically searching for a paper and pen in an old-fashioned way to write down where it is you should go to if you want to participate in the draw where you might win Courtney Cox's Yves Saint Laurent bag. If you go to the Just Giving page and literally type in Courtney Cox and Yves Saint Laurent, then exactly the right page, Caroline's page, will come up and you can just buy a ticket. It's basically a mini kind of draw and you stand a pretty good chance of winning that bag. Now, just when you'd banished thoughts of Jonathan Ross's cardigans and Celia Imrie's Loose Wind from your mind, The Traitors is back, arriving hot on the heels of its celebrity spin-off. The fourth series is going to land on New Year's Day. Is our resident TV critic as excited as I am? Well, here's Scott Bryan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of inevitable, really, that we were going to have The Traitors back on New Year's Day. I mean, it's been New Year's Day for the last sort of couple of years. I think what's noticeable, I think, are sort of two things. Firstly, the episodes are going to be not box-setted, because normally you have maybe the first three episodes that you can watch in a go with the civilian series. This time you're going to have to tune in on both New Year's Day, 2nd of Jan and 3rd of January live. But also it's actually going to be now pre-Watershed at 8 p.m. And I think that's rather interesting because, of course, The Traitors is known for being quite a high-stakes situation, having quite a few swears at times, but also it is not only one of the BBC's most popular programmes and also one of the most popular programmes in the UK, 15 million for the celebrity series, but also I think it is particularly popular with young people. So maybe it's the BBC being a bit more receptive to that. I mean, I sort of wonder what ITV and Channel 4 will be trying to put on TV at the same time. I sort of get the sense that maybe they've just given up just because this is such a gargantuan hit, but also, I guess, whether this series will be able to, I think, continue the success that it's had with the celebrity series, because, of course, the civilians, I think, take it dreadfully seriously. because of the actual money involved rather than just popularity, which does, I think, somewhat dilute the fun. Yeah, and the camaraderie something.
It's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because I think all of us who watched it were so enchanted by Alan Carr's humour, Celia Imrie's fart. You know, there was a there was a level of entertainment, wasn't there, that became so addictive to see. And I'm quite upset, Scott, by that single episode delivery of it, because I think apart from anything else, on New Year's Day, you are so wanting to be pinned down on the sofa for the entire evening and delighted. I think there's going to be a sense of frustration about that, don't you?
I think a bit of frustration. I mean, I find it's impossible for me to stay awake past 9 p.m. on New Year's Day. I think normally the night before wipes me out.
And well, that's because you've got a crazy showbiz life, Scott.
Of course, like, you know, not really doing that much and going to bed just after midnight. How ridiculously crazy. But I sort of think, I mean, it is going to be a fairly big New Year's Day. I mean, we've also got the return of the Night Manager Series 2 coming on for the sort of the same evening, of course. So rather interesting, because I know we're talking about Stranger Things in a little while, but I find it rather remarkable about how much of a gap there is now between big scripted series. And I sort of wonder, with the Night Manager, but also with Stranger Things 2, like, if you're watching the new series, you have a 5-minute recap. And I think it's because, genuinely, a lot of the audience has forgotten about what happened with the previous series. And I think all I can remember with the Night Manager Series 1, looking back, is a very pregnant Olivia Colman with a gun as a plot point. And not much else. So
yeah, I'm with you on that. I would definitely, with The Night Manager, have to go back and watch at least the last couple of episodes of the previous series. I'd have no idea what was going on. Can we talk about Stranger Things, Scott? Because, I mean, I know people who'd rearranged their holidays around the arrival of Stranger Things Season 5, and I don't know whether you were with it all the way through, but I think for people who loved it, of course they still loved it. For people who weren't that bothered, they felt Season 5 didn't quite deliver. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to point out for Netflix, I think they don't really care. I think the fact that this series has been so big for them, I think it's beaten their own internal expectations. I mean, this is, for them, the best sort of premiere week for an English language series. It's the third most popular show, I think, of all time, or maybe behind the second of Squid Game. So it's been absolutely huge. And of course, the amount of expectation for it has certainly been there. I mean, I sort of find that maybe a frustration is the fact that we're not getting the full meal here. We're only getting a few episodes. There's going to be more episodes out on Christmas Day. And then I think the final series will be on New Year's Eve. So certainly trying to capitalise between Christmas and New Year, which happen to be the most popular days of streaming of the entire year. Because that's when a lot of people try to catch up with some of the most shows, the biggest shows that they've been meaning to watch for quite a long time. So I think they'll be doing that. I mean, I think from I've only had the chance in the last week, because I've been away, to watch the first sort of two. And I think it is a good, confident series. I think the issue I find with Stranger Things is that it has sagged quite a bit in the middle, and it didn't really know where it was heading for a long while. Now it feels like it does, but am I really watching it because I'm a big Stranger Things fan, or am I watching it because I know that other people are watching it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense, yeah. I mean, sometimes I think you're watching things so you just don't miss out on the conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah, and obviously you kind of have to watch it, don't you, because it's such a momentous event thing now. Can you tell me about something that has been cropping up in ads and trailers just all across my social media and TV, which is this Pluribus programme? Am I even saying it right?
So this is the interesting thing. It is hard to know, because in Pluribus, which is a new Apple TV series made by Vince Gilligan, behind both Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, they don't actually say the word of the show Pluribus in the actual programme. And it is a Latin word that has something to do with yourself and others. Now, that makes much more sense when you're actually watching the show. It's about a sort of alien invasion, sort of that affect humanity, to make them think collectively as one. Very abstract to explain, but actually when you see it, it plays out really quite well. It's also got fantastic pacing, cinematography. It is sort of, I mean, because it's made by the people who made Breaking Bad, it's sort of like if Breaking Bad did Lost. It's quite sci-fi, but also very grounded and human. I think what I like about it and why it's worthwhile watching, I mean, it's another Apple TV show that seems to be knocking it out of the park, but of course, being on Apple TV, one of the lesser used subscription services, you have to go out your way to find it and use it. But I think like one of the biggest selling points of it is that it is an uncharted territory. I genuinely don't know where the series is going. I think it's also managing, because it's weekly episodes, it sort of created a real buzz online as people throw together their fan theories. You don't really get that with a box set series. And it also manages something that I think is incredibly hard, in which it does have really high stakes, very serious scenarios, but it manages to have incredibly incredibly good comic timing throughout. I think it's up there for me as one of my favourite shows of the year so far. I guess it comes down to whether it sticks the landing.
So we were talking there about Stranger Things returning, about Traitors arriving on New Year's Day, along with The Night Manager, and then the Apple series, which is called either Pluribus.
Okay.
We don't know, but we'll give you all the options.
I'm very excited about Traitors. I'll be hosting a full-on Traitors watch party for the launch, complete with flaming torches, capes, Scottish-themed food.
Are you as excited about the civilian version as the celebrity one?
I think so, actually, because you have no prior expectations of who people are going to be. And I think they'll probably play more emotionally and maybe more with their heart on the sleeve than the celebrities who've got sort of a big profile to worry about.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to give it a fair go too, but I suspect that I might be slightly less enthusiastic.
Maybe.
And that's just because I'm far, far shallower than you are. I'm just drawn to the light of celebrity every time, Rosie. It's very sad.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's now 3 o'clock, you're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie White on Times Radio. The Kremlin insists it's not fair to say Putin rejected the Ukraine peace plan. We'll discuss where the negotiations can go from here. We're also diving into the world of crypto, where projects linked to the Trump family are crashing harder and faster than the rest. And our big guest today is Aline van der Velden, founder of Particle 6. That's the production company behind the world's first AI actor. But first, let's get the latest news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. Kemi Badenoch has said the Chancellor should have resigned because of briefings and speculation in the run-up to the budget. Speaking at Prime Minister's Questions, the Tory leader said people had changed their behaviour as a result.
We know that there were endless Treasury briefings to justify raising taxes on hard-working people to pay for benefits. And those briefings had real-world consequences. Hundreds of thousands of people drew down their pension, an irreversible act. If the head of the OBR had to resign over market-sensitive leaks, why is the Chancellor still in her job?
Yeah. Badenoch also claimed that if Rachel Reeves worked in the private sector, she would have been sacked after last week's budget. Sir Starmer said the Conservative leader was losing the plot. Senior figures in Reform UK are suggesting that leader Nigel Farage should secure the defection of Robert Jenrick from the Tories. A senior Reform source has told The Times that the best thing for both men would be if they joined forces. The source added, Robert clearly wants to, but Jenrick denied that on Times Radio this morning, saying he's not going anywhere. A nursery worker has pleaded guilty to 26 serious sexual offences against children. 45-year-old Vincent Chan worked at a nursery in North London between 2017 and 2024. The charges against him included sexual assault and taking indecent photographs. The Met Police says it's one of the most harrowing and complex child sexual abuse investigations it's undertaken. Detective Superintendent Lewis Basford says the work continues.
Our investigation remains ongoing and we are continuing to review digital devices and assess Chan's conduct across relevant settings. If you believe you or your child may have come into contact with Vincent Chan, or if you have information that could assist our investigation, you can contact the dedicated NSPCC helpline on 0800 028 0828.
Israel is preparing to open the Rafah crossing in the coming days to allow residents of Gaza to cross into Egypt for reasons including medical treatment. A specific time has not been given. Tal Schneider, political correspondent for the Times of Israel, says there could be a hitch, however.
A source in Egypt just issued a statement saying, no, it's not going to happen because it has to be both ways. They have to let people back in and people out, and they're not agreeing to play by Israel rules, as far as we know, so far. So, I mean, I don't know if it's going to happen.
And a search is resuming for missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 11 years after it vanished. The Boeing 777 had just taken off from Kuala Lumpur, bound for Beijing with 239 people on board when it disappeared from radar screens in 2014. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for a Times news briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Now, Victoria, you can't mean it. Oh, my heavens, what an awful start to the year. Traitors, along with Strictly Come Dancing, huge yawn. You must like Traitors. I'm with you on Strictly Come Dancing. I don't want to see another episode of that. But Traitors, does it not do it for you at all? Don says, one old bag is enough in one's life, surely. No, you could have several old bags and still be happy, Don. Why not contribute and try and win Courtney Cox's old bag and do some good for cancer research at the same time? 4 minutes past three. It's Rosie Wright and Fee Glover with you until 4 o'clock. We've got a really interesting interview for you after 3:30 with the creator of the world's most successful, in brackets, so far, actor called Tilly Norwood. She is very young, she's very beautiful, she is very pleasing, she's going to be very successful, and she's not real at all, but she is already being negotiated over by Hollywood to star in AI movies. So we're going to talk about that, and we'd love your thoughts. First, though, a meeting between Ukraine's President Zelensky and US negotiators has been cancelled after peace talks in Russia ended without a breakthrough. The Kremlin said the amended peace plan was absolutely unacceptable and suggested Russia was ready for war if conflict began. But it also claimed it hadn't rejected the entire US proposal. NATO foreign ministers are meeting in Brussels today. The alliance's Secretary General Mark Rutte told reporters in the last half an hour that support for Ukraine must continue.
We all want the bloodshed to end, and I strongly welcome President Trump's continued efforts to bring about a just and lasting peace. This is vital for resolving this conflict, and we support the United States in leading this effort. And as negotiations proceed, we cannot waver in our commitment to Ukraine. Every single day, Russian missiles and drones cause death and destruction, leaving civilians without heat, light, and water as winter approaches. Ukraine's security is closely linked to our own. Our support must continue unabated to help Ukraine defend itself today and deter tomorrow.
That's the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Joining us now is Jaroslava Barbieri, Research Fellow at the Ukraine Forum at Chatham House. A very good afternoon from us. Where do you find yourself this afternoon on the spectrum of hope and despair?
Good to be with you. I mean, as many observers have pointed out, this really feels like a Groundhog Day. We've been here before. I believe that very few of us believe that we would see a strategic breakthrough in Moscow, because it's very clear from a number of statements coming from the Kremlin over the past few days that Russia's maximalist demands regarding Ukraine have not changed, although all parties need to signal this attempt to make progress and be negotiators in good faith. However, all parties' red lines have not really changed.
Just talk us through what the key territorial sticking points are and whether or not you think that there is ever going to be a negotiating table around which Russia and America can sit with Ukraine watching on, or even at the table eventually, that an agreement could be reached on.
President Zelensky has stated publicly that the issue of territorial concessions is the most controversial ones because, as we know, Russia has not been able to occupy the rest of the Donetsk regions for over 10 years now. And that missing part of the territory actually includes a belt of fortified cities that so far have helped Ukrainian forces stall any Russian advances. And therefore, also from an international law perspective, is inconceivable that Ukraine would have to seek territory it still holds. However, Russians are sort of trying to win this territory back the easy way. However, it's very important to see that both Kyiv and its European partners are unambiguously emphasizing that this is a non-starter and any territorial concessions of this sort are red lines. And so any conversations about potential territorial concessions must start at the current front line.
What is life like in some of those 45 cities this winter?
This winter is looking quite gloomy for millions of Ukrainians as Russia continues to strike critical energy infrastructure. And this is a strategy that we've seen Russia consistently playing since 2022 in an attempt to frustrate morale, both among the Ukrainian military and the wider civilian population. However, this, in a way, reflects the continued misunderstanding from Moscow of Ukrainians' willingness to resist. Too much have been sacrificed so far for Ukrainians to give in. And so a lot is at stake. And President Zelensky and his European partners are fully aware of this. What matters is the extent to which they will be able to keep the US on board, particularly when it comes to procuring key weapons that only the US can procure, particularly sophisticated air defense system that Ukraine is critically need, as well as intelligence that allows Ukraine to continue its strikes deep into Russian territory to undermine its ability to continue and wage this war.
And what are your thoughts about that continuing relationship and support between the EU and America?
I believe that also this is a consistent strategy from Moscow to try and drive a wedge between Washington and Brussels, as we've seen from recent statements from the Kremlin attempting to portray Europe's emphasis on its own red lines as being the uncooperative and stubborn party trying to undermine the so-called Trump deal, which actually was a Russian draft, effectively. And also the most recent statement that it's supposedly Europe being the warmonger, trying to undermine ongoing attempts to solve the so-called Ukraine crisis, as Russian officials refer to the full-scale invasion to really shift away blame from Moscow to Ukraine and the Europeans. And so the European leaders are trying really to navigate this very difficult balance between keeping the US on board for as long as possible, but on the other hand, being fully aware of the fact that they need to take serious steps towards strategic autonomy, because it's unclear how wide this rift within the transatlantic alliance could become.
Sure. I mean, sometimes it does feel, Jaroslava, doesn't it, as if we hear many forceful words coming from different parts of the EU. We hear forceful words coming from NATO, but it doesn't move the situation on at all. The EU, though, does appear to have reached a provisional agreement to phase out Russian gas imports by 2027. Do you think that that will mark a change? I mean, is that a significant lever?
Overall, a key problem that Europe has faced is that it has put itself in a reactive position, sort of trying to postpone or delay, prevent a worst-case scenario from happening out of the actions promoted from Moscow or Washington. The recent decision to phase out fully imports of Russian gas is, of course, welcome. However, we're talking about 2027 and also also all broader conversations about bolstering its military capabilities. Also, the time frames mentions are quite far away. So all of these decisions point to the fact that Europe is moving into the right direction, is dawning on European leaders the scale of the Russian threat. However, the scale of the response needed, I believe that Europeans are still struggling to take the kind of decisive action that they need, precisely because they're still fundamentally dependent on the US for its security needs.
Yeah, and how long do you think it's going to take for Europe to actually really look at its situation, look at the reality of its situation, not make that lean towards America? I mean, the American administration could not be clearer over the last 12 months about what it doesn't want the EU to look to it for.
I think that one important thing that the Europeans are continuing to do in order to keep the US in the game is to take full advantage of the Pearl system, the Prioritized Ukraine Requirements List, which is a mechanism that has allowed NATO's European member states to continue purchase US equipment that under the Biden administration was being provided for free. And so in a way, European leaders are providing the Trump administration with a commercial incentive, as cynical as it sounds, to keep the US on board and not fully transition towards an openly pro-Moscow position, which, as we have seen, is the proclivity of the Trump administration. Because on the other hand, we see that Moscow, in these different sort of renewed rounds of negotiations, is really trying to normalize US-Russia relations and trying to incentivize the Trump administration to adopt a pro-Russian stance on how to end the war as a potential entryway for commercial opportunities that would be to the benefit of both Moscow and Washington. And so Europe's attempts to tap into this transactionalist nature of the Trump's administration is very uncomfortable for both Europeans and Ukraine, because this war has, of course, a moral dimension, but that is the strategy currently being adopted.
Absolutely. And the moral dimension is so important, isn't it? I was watching the news last night with my 18-year-old daughter, Jaroslava, and we watched President Putin warning Europe that Russia will be ready for war with that smile that sometimes plays across his lips. The rest of his face has stopped moving. It hasn't moved for a while. But she turned to me and said, you know, are we going to be at war? And I suddenly thought, am I wrong to say to her, no, we're going to be okay? And actually, I hadn't really thought that thought before, but do you think I will come to regret my reassurance?
I mean, this is the tragic feeling that many parents have already felt in Ukraine, and this tragic feeling is now coming to a number of European families. Now, a confrontation between Europe and Russia might not look quite like what it's looking like in Ukraine. But we've seen an increase in the so-called grey zone activities with Russia's incursions into NATO airspace, with Russia's spy ships sort of mapping out our undersea cables. So all of these escalatory behaviours point to the fact that Russia really has a potential of escalatory behavior towards Europe. And so we need to take these words seriously. And we have seen recently a number of European countries exploring different models of voluntary or mandatory conscriptions, precisely because they need to shift away from this peace mindset and accept the fact that the peace that we have secured in Europe is not something to be taken for granted. It's something, it's a value that we need to be ready to fight for.
Thank you so much. It's really interesting to talk to you. That is Jaroslava Barbieri, research fellow at the Ukraine Forum at Chatham House. And she's absolutely right, isn't she, about the peace mindset.
You know, that comparison between what we might feel as parents telling our children about a potential war in Europe by comparison to what a Ukrainian parent has had to tell their children about war against Russia have seemed to be two completely different things. But, you know, we inch ever closer to that menace from Russia the more we feel its aggression in this country. It's just not coming the way of military operations. And I'm going to add the horrible word yet at the end of that. But
yet, because the question is, what is the path to peace? If this sort of current diplomacy is crawling and going so slowly, what are the other options? We mentioned that with John Pienaar earlier. Mark Rutte, the sort of NATO chief, has been speaking really in the last hour or so. And Fee, I think this is where the diplomacy gets even more complicated. He said there is only one person in the whole world who's able to break the deadlock when it comes to war in Ukraine, and that is Donald Trump. Donald Trump, who said in the last couple of weeks or so that Zelensky and the Ukrainians have not been grateful enough for the support that America's been providing. And so President Zelensky trying to toe that line of defending his country and also trying to keep on side with a US president who's very happy to have all those conversations with Putin. Complicated. Lots to come here on the programme. We are going to be working out what the memory chip crisis means for you. Yes, listen up. It's 18 minutes past three. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Show me the money! No? We'll be joined by Times columnist Fraser Nelson and the Sunday Times' Charlotte Ivers.
And Andrew Riley will bring us his best letters to the Times this week.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year, we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
News now of an exciting competition on Times Radio in association with Thomas Fudgers, who makes some of the Britain's finest biscuits. In fact, we ate about 14 in our production meeting this morning. This Christmas, you could celebrate Christmas in style with a Yuletide trip you'll never forget. We're giving you the chance to win an enchanting three-night Christmas getaway for two in either Vienna, Prague or Copenhagen. The delicious experience includes flights, luxury hotel accommodation, dinner and £500. For your chance to win something extra special, thanks to Thomas Fudge's excellent biscuits, simply go online and search for Times Radio Competitions. You'll find the entry form on the website. One entrant will be selected at random from all valid entries, and the competition closes at midnight on Sunday, the 14th of December. All the terms and conditions are online. Very best of luck.
It's 21 minutes past three. Now, winter is coming. Crypto winter, that is. Eric Trump's cryptocurrency firm lost nearly 40% of its value yesterday in less than half an hour. Tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker is here to tell us some more. Chris, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Rosie.
It was a very dramatic half hour on Wall Street. So what happened? Everything opens at 9:30 and things go south very quickly.
Yeah, within a matter of minutes. In fact, literally 1 minute for many of these big Bitcoin companies. So we have obviously seen the Trump administration and the Trump family putting a lot of stock, literally, almost, in the promise of cryptocurrencies. Donald Trump has hired pro-crypto people to join his administration to allow this sort of use of crypto to replace traditional financial services in the United States. But unfortunately, what can go up does sometimes go down. And so we have seen very much a yo-yo situation this week with crypto stocks, as you mentioned, including some of those that are set up by the Trump family with massive losses. So 40%, as you mentioned there. Others have seen huge similar drops. And basically, I think this is a reckoning at the minute with crypto. They don't really know what to do with it, the stock market, and they are a little bit worried about how it is going to play out. And so it is, I think, an indication and perhaps a caution for us all of not necessarily putting too much money into this sort of thing, because it is far more volatile than even the stock market is traditionally.
Yeah. Why, though, yesterday such a dramatic slide and so quickly? Do we have any theories as to that?
Yeah, so I mean, basically, I think there is a concern that this is in some ways linked to the uncertainty that we're seeing broadly around the sort of tech space. There is, I think, a real worry around whether or not crypto is actually ready for the real sort of times that we're seeing. And I think that is a big sort of concern that we're seeing in terms of, there is this idea that Donald Trump wants to realize this kind of crypto haven and turn the United States into one. But actually, there does seem to be a real concern that actually the US politicians that are around the Trump family won't necessarily allow this. So generally, crypto has been going down in value from record highs over the last month or two. I think this week in particular, it was just a sort of worry that actually this doesn't live up to the reality.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot of this is wedded to President Trump, isn't it? Because as soon as he was re-elected for the second time, with a lot of the things he was saying about cryptocurrency, there was a real boom, and that hasn't been able to be sustained.
Yeah, and one of the problems that we have is that obviously cryptocurrency is very much dependent on the ability to mine these new coins. Not to get into too much detail around it, but it is this concept that you will always find new cryptocurrencies and new Bitcoin, for instance, until a point at which there is no more. So mining in the same sort of way that you would mine for coal, or that you would dig up oil and find oil wells to exploit there. The concern with that, I suppose, is that actually you know, there are some questions being asked around where you're going to get these things from. And really, I suppose that actually the idea is maybe this is harder to get these cryptocurrencies mined than actually we would first think. You know, they do rely an awful lot on computer parts that are sometimes subject to Donald Trump's own whims in terms of whether or not he slaps tariffs on them. Mm. Very much reliant on the international supply chain, which again, Donald Trump likes to play with a little bit.
Chris, I'm not going to ask you to explain it again. I think despite many people's best efforts, the concept of mining cryptocurrency has never quite actually sunk down into my brain to fully understand and comprehend it. But I think we can see what's happening to cryptocurrencies at large. Second story for us, there is the sort of the frenzied demand for AI is pushing us towards a supply problem with memory chips. Why should we sort of care about the memory chip?
Unfortunately, because memory chips are used in lots of different things beyond AI, and so they are increasingly used in our laptops, in our phones, and what that means is that as there is an increased shortage because of the AI revolution that we're seeing, the prices for those are likely to go up, sometimes, Rosie, by 20 to 30% in the next 6 months. So if you're out there planning what you're going to get your friends and family for Christmas, if you're thinking of any sort of IT device, it is probably best to buy those now before these chips become incredibly short. So we're talking here about what is called DRAM, which is memory that you put into your laptops. It makes your phones actually run well. If you don't have enough of that, then it means that your phone or your laptop runs relatively slowly. Traditionally, they have been made by manufacturers in places like South Korea and Taiwan. Generally, what has happened is they have been happy getting the returns from those DRAM chips. But with the AI revolution and some of the massive valuations that we have seen over the last several years, including obviously, you know, the $5 trillion valuation of Nvidia that we had late last month before it dropped down again, those manufacturers are saying, well, we want to focus on the money-making chips, which are the AI chips, rather than these more basic, simple ones for our devices. And so that is leading to massive shortfalls and a sort of reduction in the stocks that are available to you. So we did have at one point around about a year or almost 18 months worth of these memory chips to be able to use. And now we're down to, I think, something like 2 or 3 months. So really dwindling supplies here.
You mentioned that Nvidia valuation that did surprise quite a few people because we've been talking so much about this AI bubble. We've heard from the Bank of England this week a warning that the AI bubble is fueled by debt. Can you explain what the Bank of England are worried about?
Yeah, they're hugely concerned. Andrew Bailey spoke this week about his fears around this. Generally, tech as a sector is one that is invested in and fueled by debt. Generally, you have either venture capitalists or investors more broadly who think, actually, I don't necessarily want to put real money into this. And similarly, the tech companies themselves like to operate on a way where their money comes in through investors and then it goes immediately out to their products and their services and the continued development of their business. And I think that is a real worry for those who are perhaps more steeped in the traditional way of doing finance. Andrew Bailey obviously has a huge responsibility in terms of his role with the Bank of England to ensure financial propriety. And I think he is a bit concerned about the fact that a lot of what is happening in the AI space is being fueled by debt, some of which he believes could be unsustainable, in part because of the discussions that are being had around whether or not this is a bubble. We've talked previously about Sam Altman, OpenAI's CEO, basically admitting that he does think the market is overhyped at the minute. There have been many others. Bill Gates has said that he sees there's a frenzy at the minute in the market. Some people do disagree. Jensen Huang, who is CEO of Nvidia, the chip company, obviously because he is making hay at the minute, believes that it's not a bubble. But there is a worry, I suppose, that not only is this fueled by debt, but there is an element of sort of circular economy going on here. Companies that have a lot of cash spare, like Nvidia, giving that cash to some of the companies that they are using as clients to buy their own chips back from them. And that, I think, is a big thing that is concerning Andrew Bailey right now.
Chris, thank you very much for explaining. Chris Stokel-Walker, the tech journalist, bringing us up to speed.
So James has had a real life experience of this. It's a nightmare. I just purchased RAM for my son's computer for Christmas. 250 quid now. A year ago, it was under £100. Sue says, Rosie, I doubt if Trump even understands cryptocurrency apart from something he and his family can make money from. And just jumping back to our previous conversation about Ukraine and the way forward, Neil says, what a waste of space the European countries are, still buying Russian gas 3 years after the war has started, getting its knickers in a twist about seizing Russian money. If I were Donald Trump, I think I'd walk away and leave Europe to whatever it deserves. We are 0333 003 2353. Coming up, would you see a film featuring only AI-generated actors? That is all going to happen after a check on the latest news headlines at 3:30. Here's Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
QP, good afternoon. Senior figures in Reform UK are suggesting that leader Nigel Farage should secure the defection of Robert Jenrick from the Tories. A senior source told The Times that the best thing for both men would be if they joined forces. The source added Robert clearly wants to, but Jenrick denied that on Times Radio this morning, saying he's not going anywhere. Tory leader Kemi Badenocher said the head of the Office for Budget Responsibility was forced out for telling the truth. The OBR said a downturn in productivity used to justify tax increases was balanced out by a rise in tax receipts. Its former head, Richard Hughes, resigned on Monday. A nursery worker has admitted sexually assaulting children in North London. 45-year-old Vincent Chan pleaded guilty to 26 offences. Police say he exhibited a calculated and predatory pattern of abuse over a number of years. Here's Detective Superintendent Lewis Basford.
Vincent Chan is a paedophile. He's disturbed predatory and a sexual offending took advantage of young children.
using his workplace to gain access to his victims. He exploited the trust placed in him by the victims' families and the promise to care for their children.
The nursery group involved is reviewing safeguarding procedures. And males who identify as females are going to be banned from joining the Women's Institute. It says it's made the decision following a ruling from the Supreme Court in April that said the words man and woman refer to biological sex. Yesterday, Girl Guiding said it would do the same thing. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a national book token. Buy now for Christmas in bookshops everywhere and online.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7 p.m. as she brings you tomorrow's Times Today, an exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, in just a few years' time, we may well all be settling down of an evening to watch the latest rom-com or action movie starring characters we've come to know and love but who never appear in the gossip columns or have babies or get divorced or fall out of clubs late at night or make a fortune advertising perfumes at this time of year or cars or pants. Because they will be completely AI-generated. The tech is here and the stars are being born. If you type Tilly Norwood into a search engine, you will see images of a very pretty, petite, freckled brunette girl who's an aspiring actress and describes herself as the world's first AI star. And Tilly is entirely AI. She's ruffled a few feathers in Hollywood. Emily Blunt described her as really, really scary. Whoopi Goldberg is amongst many people to publicly criticise her existence. And her creator is Aline Valdevelden. She is the founder of Particle 6. She's made several shows for the BBC as a producer, is working with all of the main broadcasters now, and is a trained actress herself.
I'm from a small island in the Caribbean called Curaçao, and I came to the UK when I was 14 to do musical theatre at a wonderful performing arts school called Tring Park. And I was really proud to come to, you know, the global creative powerhouse in the world, Britain, to be trained up in this creative field. And I then went on to study physics at Imperial College. And I created characters all throughout my 20s. I was an actor. I was a director. I was a writer. I did all the things. And I also created a character called Miss Holland, which is like a female sort of buffoonish character that won Best Online Comedy at the Lovey Awards and then got picked up by the BBC. So I've been always creating characters. And it was only 3 years ago when ChatGPT came out, and I think the physicist inside me was ignited with joy that I could merge my two loves of the creative and the tech together and convert my production company, which is called Particle 6, into an AI production studio, really.
So one of the creations to come out of your production studio is the AI actress Tilly Norwood. So for people who haven't come across her, how would you describe her? What's her CV?
Oh, well, her CV is non-existent still. I thought of her in February. I could see all the AI influencers popping up. Lil Michaela had been signed by CAA a few years back. And I was really fascinated by this AI world that was emerging. I've always also, with Britishness in mind, sort of, you know, British talent has always been huge in our entertainment industry. And I thought, well, this whole new AI genre is going to need British talent too. We're going to have to be on the forefront of this AI creative renaissance. And I thought, let's make an AI actress so she can play parts, because we're creating all this content in AI genre, which is fully AI. We need an actor that's going to do all these jobs for us. So I thought, but okay, well, it's a long process. How do we create this actress? What's she going to be called? You know, we don't want to infringe on anyone's likeness or any, you know, person. So we need to create a full original person here. That was really important to us. We're a very ethical production company. You know, we don't want to be infringing on anyone's likeness or copyright. So in our prompts, we are very specific about that. So we started with the name. We were like, okay, she needs a name that's resonant, that feels British, that people around the world would easily remember, but also that nobody else has. And so Tilly Norwood, according to our research, was a name, one of, yeah, I had to choose, you know, from many, but was a name that nobody had. And I know Ryan Reynolds really tried to find a Tilly Norwood and he couldn't. He found a Natalie Norwood, but not Tilly Norwood. And so that was, so it's like an onion, you know, you peel off the layers as you go. So the name, and then it was her look, right? Her likeness. And we wanted that sort of English Rose look, the type that would get cast in a drama, but, you know, not too beautiful, a bit girl next door, resonant around the world, that also represented the melting pot that we are in Britain. So there's so much thought that went into it. And I think we did around 2,000 iterations of her before I was like, yes, that's who I want. So, and now we're going into the whole brain and her personality and we're creating who she is. And it gets more and more exciting as we get deeper into the process.
What is she going to be used for? Where am I going to see her? When you talk about her being in movies, surely she will only be in movies that are entirely AI generated. She's not going to play alongside Paul Mescal in something, is she?
So she could, but we've said no to all those opportunities that have come our way because we don't feel that's right. We don't want her to be taking the place of real actors. I love real actors. I want to keep watching real actors, you know, in drama and in beautiful stories. That's really key to me. Also, as our business, Particle 6, we enhance TV and film with AI, and to actually get more projects to be greenlit and go into production, thus creating more jobs. And, you know, we do some of the complex scenes with VFX or with establishing shots or animals with AI. This is exactly as you're saying, all in the AI space, really about a whole new genre. It's, you know, just like animation, but with more realistic looks. And you can tell beautiful stories in this new art form. And just because there's a new art form doesn't mean the old one becomes obsolete.
Mm. I can hear in all of your answers so far, Elaine, that you might already feel a bit on the back foot with the criticism that has come your way about creating an AI actress. So just tell me a little bit about that before, you know, before I ask you the questions that I think you've been asked before. Because people at the moment are fearful of what is being created, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I think our fear, I don't think it's misplaced, actually.
We are going to go through a transition period. So part of this is also me future-proofing my business. There's going to be a displacement of jobs, just like there has been in many previous moments in time where we've changed the way that we do work. But it doesn't mean that it completely becomes obsolete, the traditional stuff either, right? It's a transition. We need to upskill a lot of people. We are hiring. This is a huge moment of growth and job creation that actually people are not seeing. And there's the big miscommunication and the big misinformation. They think AI, just because it uses AI, there's going to be job losses. We're seeing the opposite right now. We're seeing huge amount of job creation. So maybe we've got it wrong to a certain extent. Maybe it's just going to be a transition period and actually the net effect is going to be more productivity, more jobs.
So many people in the creative industries, though, have already said, we don't want this to be happening so fast. We do think we're going to lose our jobs because, of course, if you're a lighting cameraman at the moment and you haven't been trained in AI, the notion that a Tilly Norwood franchise movie might take off that would never need your skills is terrifying to you. So I hear you when you say that the AI industry creates jobs, but at the moment it takes them in the creative industries.
Not only, right? So we are hiring AI DOPs that work with the AI to be a director of photography. So jobs will change. I really, really strongly believe that because I'm seeing this and we've been in this for 3 years now. Look, some jobs will change. I'm not going to deny that whatsoever. But I think if people upskill, they're less likely to be at the threat of this. And there are huge opportunities for people who are AI literate. And at the same time, some of these traditional jobs will remain. You know, you're going to keep doing this in a studio.
I doubt it.
I really do think so. I really do think there is place for this, but alongside the traditional stuff. I really think people still want real people. It's boring to only have AI.
Mm. Tilly Norwood is an extremely attractive young woman. So for the purposes of radio, we've got to describe her. She's got very long dark hair. She's got kind of dark hazel eyes. She's got a very symmetrical beauty about her. And I wonder, as a woman and a woman who's worked in the acting profession, why you went for that kind of prettiness, because in a way she's enforcing what, for so, I mean, 99.9% of the population is an unachievable goal. Would you agree?
Yeah, so I mean, we created her together with the AI to be as most resonant around the world and to really be a global superstar. I didn't think she would get to this so fast, so clearly the AI did something right there in creating the way that she looks, you know, and including my knowledge of the industry, that there's some things we can't deny. And that's why she was our first creation. And she has a certain beauty about her. But also, we didn't want her to be too beautiful, right? So there's a fine line there that you have to walk. You know, she's got that girl next door vibe, and she's got imperfections in her skin. We had images before that were really airbrushed and it was too beautiful. So we don't want that either. Now,
did you think about making her different? You know, maybe making her a bit plumper, maybe, yeah.
Well,
making
we made
her
sure
hair
that she's,
uncontrollable.
Yeah, her hair is uncontrollable in some shots, and her weight fluctuates from shot to shot. But we make sure that what we put out there is a healthy weight, and we do think about all these things, because I'm very aware, as I was a young girl once too, and how affected you can be by these images. But what's most important is we make it really clear that she's AI. And in a way, that makes it better, because you know that it's not a real person. And so you're not trying to emulate to be like her, because you know it's not real. Whilst I think what's way more dangerous is to seeing real people who are pretending to be a certain size, which people are doing, and they are changing it with AI, or they're changing, you know, filters and changing their shape and all sorts of things. And that's not actually real, even with the, you know, plastic surgery and stuff. So I think actually that's more dangerous than just saying, look, this is an AI actress. She's not real.
And how do you actually kind of own her? You know, you say that you've created her, and obviously your company has a kind of copyright over her image. But what does that mean? Does that mean that a producer could phone you up and say, I've written this script, I want Tilly Norwood in it, and you'd just kind of hand over the algorithms to them? How does it work?
It's more complex. I suppose it's about the human work and input into making the character. So we spend about 6 months making her, and loads of iterations and thought that went into her. But then there's also the trademark to protect her name. And then when it comes to roles, I mean, it would have to be a full AI film for us to say yes to the job offer, so to speak. And, you know, people online are making lots of fan content with her, and we actually love it. We think that's great. So you can't protect, you know, the internet's such a cowboyish place anyway. You don't want to be, you know, dampening people's creativity. If they want to create something fun with her, I'm all for that.
Mm. Can she have a difficult personality?
Yes. So this is where it becomes super creative and really fun is, you know, we have this instruction manual that we're creating for her brain, and what her sense of humor is like, how she responds. And also, she's a rebel. We created her, and this is visible on our Instagram. We created her a few days ago, and we said, oh, could you just jump around and say woohoo? And then we played some of the iterations. She just wasn't wearing any trousers.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, we think we're in control of this AI, but
why wasn't she wearing any trousers?
I mean, because she just didn't feel like it. It really said, you're wearing blue jeans. She just ignored it. So, you know, the brain, what's fascinating about it, it's this neural network in AI that we don't really understand. It's very similar to the brain. We don't really understand it.
But sorry, can I just ask, and this is a terrible thought, but is she doing that because actually what the AI has learned through scraping the internet is that many, many pretty girls are out there without clothes on?
Yes, there is that. So I am always, you know, it's trained on my data as well, right? It's trained on everyone. I'm always saying, look, if you can add something to that training data, please do, because the more diverse that data is, the better. The more we'll get interesting things, but the more diverse it becomes as well. So actually, I feel it as a duty to the human race to be donating material to the training algorithm for diversity in it to increase. I wrote this thing about how I tried to create a woman with hairy legs a few years ago, and I couldn't because there was no training data for it.
We do have to change that.
We do. And
so hold it to for your future characters that you create at your company, will they reflect more diverse female shapes and maybe age and
everything,
and less, I suppose, classically attractive would be helpful for that AI scrape, wouldn't it?
It would. It also makes the story more interesting. So yes, Tilly was our first one and she did what she needed to do. She got the conversation going. But, we want more diverse characters to tell beautiful stories. That's really important. And just to go back to the control of the AI, when you're creating this brain, it's a little bit like bringing up a child, right? You give them morals and values and direction. And then when you unleash them and let them be autonomous, you just hope for the best. Mm.
Are you confident, though, and do you think that we can hope for the best with AI creations like this? Because my fear is that there's just so much bad stuff out there and so many images of women, how women don't want to be, that actually it is too much of a struggle to imagine that the AI world can reflect a better place. It's just going to milk the worst, isn't it?
I think that's what you need good production companies to be engaging with it and making interesting content. So that's what we're trying to do. Look, it's going to happen. AI is here. It's here to stay. As much as we can't put it back in the box. So instead, let's move forward. Let's get people upskilled using this tech for good. Make it a force for good. Using it ethically. Don't reference any copyrighted material in your prompts. Don't reference any specific people's likeness. Let's move forward as an industry. Let's train it well so it's diverse. And let's use it. And I see it as us standing on the top of the shoulders of humanity and going forth, moving forward and using it in a good way.
How old is Tilly Norwood at the moment?
We say 24.
24, okay.
But she can be any age you want her to be.
Right. Is she going to age in real time? What's she like when she hits the menopause?
People ask this question a lot, which I just think is fascinating. We can age her if we wanted to. It's more of a creative personal choice of ours, I suppose.
Yeah, I think she should age. I think it'd be terrible if she stayed 24 forever.
We'll have other characters soon or not.
I know that you've been surprised, Celine, about the backlash that there has been against the creation of Tilly Norwood. And to be honest, I was surprised that you were surprised. Were you genuinely not expecting it?
There were so many AI characters out there. There was the Lil Michaela example. We were just following the same playbook as her, and she had not received any backlash.
And there have been K-pop bands, haven't there, created?
All sorts.
I'm going to get it. Is it Breaking Rust, which is the AI country artist that topped the Billboard charts? There is stuff
there's
out
loads.
There.
There's loads of things. So, I didn't think this was that original. I just thought, I'm just jumping on the bandwagon. I thought everyone was doing this. I mean, everyone can create an AI character on VO3 or Sora, right? It's publicly available. Now, I think the difference is Tilly looked very real. And that was quite shocking to people. And it was shocking to me when I first saw it. I was like, oh my goodness, this is where the tech's at. And I'm really proud, actually, that she was able to spark that conversation and open everybody's eyes up to where the tech's at. Because I worry that most of these people had never seen this before. And I'd been playing with these tools for the past year. And so I'm like, hold on, you didn't know this was possible? That's more worrying than the fact I've put this actress out.
Yeah, so I completely hear you on that, because when I started looking at Tilly on, there's some bits and pieces that you can see of her on Instagram. If I grazed across that without knowing who she is and without knowing your story, I absolutely just would have believed her to be a real young woman, out and about going to a premiere or whatever it is that she's doing. How do we in future ensure that we know when we're watching AI and when we don't? Not everything is going to be watermarked or stamped or whatever.
So on Instagram, you can put an AI label on it. I think we've been very transparent about the fact she's an AI actress, which is what's caused all this fuss. I think it's really important to make the distinction.
Yeah. Can I ask you about being an entrepreneur in this country? Because yes. Obviously you've done some extraordinary things with your company, and I bet that an awful lot of venture capitalists have been knocking on your door and stuff like that. Do you feel happy in the UK? Are you immediately off to Heathrow to take a flight to wherever it might be that offers you better tax breaks, perhaps less national insurance contributions, that type of stuff?
Look, these conversations are happening amongst the entrepreneurs, for sure. I feel very settled in the UK. I'm really proud to be in the UK. Britishness is in my work. I would say I was surprised there was no mention of AI in the budget. I do think as a country, we have a unique opportunity where the government has actually was very AI forward. And that has led me to be very AI forward, which is good. And actually, I think we're ahead of the Americans right now in this creative AI space.
Do you?
Yes. Very much.
Well,
so.
Even though they've got the great big kind of...
They've got the big tech companies.
The whopper ones over there.
Yeah, but yeah. Many producers in the UK are engaging with this. Many of the big broadcasters. And that isn't happening so much in the US yet. They're all very scared, which I also understand. But it's a creative opportunity for us to keep our place in that creative industry with these new tools. And I think if we skill everybody up really fast... And we get AI literacy really high, we could really have an important role to play in this new economy.
So it's interesting that you note it was an omission in the budget, because actually the business secretary, Peter Carr, is incredibly keen to tell voters, tell our listeners that we're right at the forefront of AI. So what should we have heard that would actually have made a difference, do you think?
Gosh, and you're asking me very political questions.
Yeah, no, I'm not looking for anything specific, but just what...
Yeah, what would help?
Yeah.
I think a huge amount of, you know, money towards upskilling. That's really needed right now. Skilling people up, especially youngsters. We're hiring, you know, people will worry that because it's AI, we're not hiring young people. That's absolutely not true. We're training up a lot of young people. We're working with Screen Skills and other industry bodies to help get those people trained up. So a contribution towards that would be really helpful as a business, and also budget towards making new AI productions in the creative industries would be also good. Mm. There's no budget right now where you can go to get
no fund where you can say, yep, you know, you invest in me and I'm going to,
and we're going to do a world's first feature film, which we're doing, but you know, if the government were to assist in that, in helping creative producers in the UK produce AI content, I think we could really be onto something.
How lovely to meet you. Thank you very much indeed for coming into Times Towers today. And dear listener, she's real. She's absolutely real. That is Aline van der Velden. Well, so many of you are very, very engaged with this topic, and we all should be, really. Suzanne says, I'm sorry to be contrary, but believing in the positive side of AI won't make it so. What's always amusing is that the people who do put their skills and faith in it are, and after all, it is the newest religion, don't see how they're chipping away at their own futures, not just those of others. AI will make them surplus to requirements too. But let's leave it to the industry to regulate itself, because that works really well in other aspects of the tech sector. I hear you on that one, Suzanne. This one comes in anonymously, but it says, so what about the job creation? What's the point of replacing a real actor with an AI actor when the reason an actor or actress is valued is their emotional performance and how they interpret a role? And Andy says, Aline is absolutely correct. I'm 57 and retired from financial services 3 years ago. I now work in AI. It is fascinating and world-changing, and the Luddites are getting too much airtime.
Ah, there you go. Well, do you know what has convinced some people was the Coca-Cola advert. This time last year, of course, they released that made by AI. They've done the same again this year. And, you know, we think, oh, how compelling will video audio be that's been made by a code or a person actually writing the code rather than an actor or that real sort of human experience. But it is already there in some capacity. I think the biggest test will be what appetite we have for content that isn't sort of deeply rooted in the human experience.
Yeah. And it's up to us to keep going back to the cinema to see actors, real actors, play real parts in real movies. I think the incredibly sad thing, and one that is going to stay with me for a very long time, is the fact that you put Tilly Norwood out there in the cyber world, the inevitability of a young, pretty woman existing in cyber reality is that AI gets her to take her clothes off pretty much from the get-go. So that just shows you what it is that is shaping AI at the moment.
Yeah, and how it can be corrupted so quickly.
That's just horrendous, because that's just what young women are expected to do, and that's what AI finds young women doing on the internet. And I'd like that to change, please. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
This festive season, it's your turn to be crowned best gift giver and most imaginative host with a little chocolate magic from Hotel Chocolat. From tipples and desserts reimagined in chocolate form, to reefs you can nibble, or two-foot-long crackers bursting with imaginative chocolates. You'll find everything you need to captivate one and all this season, in-store and online at Hotel Chocolat.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Oh, we like contrast on the text. James says, why do upper middle class people such as actors and successful journalists call AI a great threat to jobs and people's lives, but say nothing of the manual working class jobs that are constantly automated by physical machines? But Neil says on WhatsApp, I think you're absolutely correct that AI will indeed replace an awful lot of mediocre presenters on radio. You can actually already get an AI DJ on Spotify if you like. However, for that very same reason, I think you, Fee, and Rosie will be safe. Well, that's very kind, Neil, saying that you have wit and very good investigative questions that AI could never replicate. That compliment very much at your feet, Fee.
I mostly use ChatGPT for them. I'm joking, Neil. I don't. Do you know what? I just want to say hello to Alison, who says, oh my goodness, AI women, something else to have to compete against. I'm horrified. It's frightening. It's awful. Take me back to the 70s immediately. I really understand where you're coming from, Alison. I think if Tilly Norwood had been a 57-year-old, middle-aged, slightly underwhelming actress, I would have had so much more time for the creation. Rosie and I will be back tomorrow from 2. Up next, it's John Pina with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Rosie. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pina, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. A nursery worker admitted sexually assaulting children in North London. And senior figures in Reform UK are suggesting Nigel Farage should secure the defection of Robert Jenrick from the Tories. And coming up, as the future of Ukraine continues to involve a good deal of diplomatic talk but not much movement towards peace, we're going to be looking at what life is like under Russian occupation and talking about the resistance movements that are fighting back on the and behind the front line. I'm going to be looking to how one NHS trust is preparing ahead of the resident doctors' strike and discussing why the World Cup in the United States could be the most expensive ever seen.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Senior figures in Reform UK are suggesting that leader Nigel Farage should secure the defection of Robert Jenrick from the Tories. A source told The Times that the best thing for both men would be if they joined forces. The source added, Robert clearly wants to. Jenrick was asked about this by Stig Abel on Times Radio this morning.
We have heard rumours
of Reform members getting excited about you coming over to be a Chancellor in a Reform government. You, Robert Jenrick, coming over and being seen as a future Chancellor. What do you say to that?
Well, it wasn't very long ago that I was running to be leader of the Conservative Party, so I'm not going anywhere.
Meanwhile, the Conservative leader has told MPs the Chancellor would have been sacked if she worked in the private sector. During Prime Minister's questions, Kemi Badenoch said Rachel Reeves' position is untenable.
If she was a CEO, she would have been fired. And she might even have been prosecuted for market abuse. That's why we've written to the Financial Conduct Authority. So will the Prime Minister ensure the Chancellor fully cooperates with any investigation?
Reeves made it clear she did not accept that accusation. The Tories claim that in the run-up to the budget, confidential information may have been spun, leaked and misused. This was Sir Keir Starmer's reply.
She's completely losing the plot. She says take responsibility. Under this Chancellor, Mr Speaker, growth is up this year, defeating and beating the forecast. Wages are up, more since the general election than in 10 years of the Tories. We've had, I think, 5 interest rate cuts.
A nursery worker has admitted sexually assaulting children in North London. 45-year-old Vincent Chan pleaded guilty to 26 offences. Police say he exhibited a calculated and predatory pattern of abuse over a number of years. Supermarkets are to get updated guidance confirming that baby formula can be bought using loyalty schemes and coupons. The Prime Minister says it could save new parents about £500 a year. A meeting between Volodymyr Zelensky and a US delegation has been cancelled after talks in Russia on the war in Ukraine concluded without a breakthrough. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says Vladimir Putin accepted some of the proposals and rejected others in what he described as a normal negotiation process. Males who identify as females are going to be banned from joining the Women's Institute. It says it's made the decision following a ruling from the Supreme Court in April that said the words man and woman refer to biological sex. Yesterday, Girl Guiding said it would do the same thing. And the King and Queen have welcomed the German President to Windsor Castle for a state visit. Frank-Walter Steinmeier and his wife will be treated to a state banquet. A 6-metre Christmas tree decorated with 3,000 lights will be the backdrop to these celebrations. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, thanks for joining me. I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. The Kremlin is calling the latest round of Russia-USA talks on ending the war in Ukraine constructive. Constructive. If that was constructive, what would deadlock look like? If that was constructive, what would a charade with Vladimir Putin and his team stringing along President Trump and his team look like? Well, the answer is it would look exactly like this. Ukraine's leaders are offering to talk if Russia will talk to Ukraine. European leaders are trying hard to be in on the talking. All Ukraine's friends are hoping President Trump doesn't lose interest and walk away. And Russia... well, Russia's insisting they're ready to talk, and all the while waging war, hoping to wear down Ukraine's friends and making life for Ukrainians as close to hell as possible. And that, the lives of Ukrainians living this war, feeling the pain of the Russian invasion, is what we maybe hear too little about. We hear little of resistance against the Russians in occupied Ukraine. But resistance there is. Fighters and saboteurs who risk a terrible retribution for their work against the occupying forces. Now, in a moment, I'll be talking to an academic who has been in regular contact with the Ukrainian resistance, studying their operations and their work against the Russian military. What are you thinking about where we are now and where we're going? Assuming you think we're going anywhere at all, send me a text, 87222, stop with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. But now, though, as I promised, I can welcome to the programme Dr. Jade McGlynn, who's from the War Studies Department at King's College London. Hello to you, Dr. McGlynn.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So, look, we hear comparatively little or very little about a Ukrainian resistance movement, but there is one, Dr. McGlynn, and it is definitely active.
Yes, it's quite remarkably active given the incredibly repressive environment of the occupied territories. The vast majority of resistance, by most measurements, around 90%, is sending coordinates, so-called human intelligence, to explain where this or that military base of the Russians may be located. But that's incredibly useful. Often we talk about the occupied territories as just these conquered lands to be forgotten, but of course they are just the other side of the front line. And there is an incredible amount of information that is sent both ways. There are, of course, also much more, I suppose, just standard explosive resistance activities. We've been tracking, my research assistant and I have been tracking different actions over a fortnightly basis. And in general, we have between 13 to 15 violent acts of resistance. That might be the assassination of FSB officers, Russian Security Service counterintelligence. That might be blowing up railway lines that provide logistics for the military. But considering we're nearly 4 years in, it's really quite remarkable.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And as you say, we don't hear a great deal about these operations. Are they impactful? Do the sabotage and killing of the enemy operations that have taken place, are they significantly hurting the Russian military?
I think the best example here is to give the best way to answer this question is to give a specific example. So everybody knows, or most people know, about Operation Spiderweb, which was the famous SD operation where they sent in. That operation was only possible because of a man from Donetsk who went back into occupation. So he was living in free Ukraine, went back into occupation, took a Russian passport, lived quietly his life, setting up his lorry business, and then, of course, provided all of the lorries through which the drones were sent. So often I think it's very dangerous, and it's far too dangerous to compile, full lists of all of the operations around. Probably about 20% of what the resistance get up to ever becomes in any form public. But they're consistently having an impact. They're consistently slowing the Russian advances. And bluntly, Ukraine needs all of the help it can get.